clear-cut idea of what has actually happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women desperately in need will see these pages, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that they will be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. And if you will help me welcome our speaker tonight from Fredericksburg, Cliff. All right.
Well, darn. He just stole the first thing I was going to be talking about. Was marked and underlined. Each individual in a personal story is described in his own language and from his own point of view. The way he developed. I mean, that's. Hi, everybody. My name's Cliff, and I am an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is May 27, 2005. Yeah, that's right. That makes it 16. Unfortunately, I have two, so I confuse them sometimes. The first one was September 26, 1995. And I don't know if I'll get around to explaining what happened and how that change went on or not, but because I don't know what I'm going to talk about right now. I'm going to say a little prayer, and if y'all don't like what you hear, sitting right there, Billy, he's the one that asked me. Hi, everybody on Zoom, and otherwise, you know, talk to your higher power about it, too, because I'm asking him to help me with what I'm going to say. You know, and how it works, it says, you know, we tell in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what it was like, and what it's like now. And to kind of mesh that paragraph that Michael read with what it was like, what happened, what it's like now, I see my life in three stages. What it was like without a personal God in my life, what happened to cause me to need and want a personal life, God in my life, and what it's like now with a conscious contact with a personal God in my life. So, you know, I think that they are, you know, two things that really can be meshed together. I will start out by saying, you know, I'm not much, but I'm all I think about. So I'm going to talk about me right now. And everything I say about the God that I used to have, and it tells us it in the big book. It says some of us had a God that was impressed upon us as a child. But I don't want anybody to think my mother was telling me about a mean, evil, scorekeeping God. Because my mother had the most wonderful relationship and loving relationship with the God of her, you know, in her life of any person I know. But as with most things, what you say and what I hear are not always the same thing. And I don't know how that's going to work tonight. Because I can tell you, I have spoken sometimes and have people come up and say, yeah, I loved it when you said whatever, and I'm like, I've never said that. So you know, I like the fact that when we ask God into the meetings that that people are going to hear what they need to hear, regardless of how stupid I might sound saying something. But my story is really kind of boring. You know, I never had DUI, never got drunk in public. Sometimes I feel unworthy to be in some of the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous based on the stories I hear. And I like the analogy someone said one time. It's kind of like you have the spy that gets captured and they're trying to get the spy to talk. And, you know, James Bond and those, you know, real good spies, I mean, they'll shock them for weeks. And they'll, no, I won't talk. No, I won't talk. And then finally, when they're just a puddle on the floor, it's like, okay, I give, I'll talk. You know, that's what I think about some of when I hear some of the stories of people in here. For myself, just show me the wires. That was enough. I get. As far as the outside goes. But I will tell you, I will compare the black hole and the fear, the loneliness, the depression that was going on in my life and then, you know, between my ears with anybody's, you know. I started drinking at a real young age. I was fortunate. My parents, you know, my father was a doctor over in Fredericksburg, and I'm the youngest of four. My brothers and sisters are 6, 8, and 10 years older than I am. So basically, I was kind of an only child. But you know, when I was 10, they were all going off doing whatever they wanted to do. I never remember having a babysitter because they were all told, y'all can do whatever you want to, but you got to take your little brother with you. And I can only gauge what my age was for certain things going on in my life based on their age. And my brother was at UVA, and he brought a bunch of fraternity brothers back to the house one weekend when my parents were out of town, and they just had a great party. But my brother was like 19, maybe 20, which means I was 9 or 10. And I still remember his fraternity brother, his nickname was Skull, calling me over to the piano and saying, Cliff, I'll give you $2 if you finish this Jack Daniels. And it was a bottle of Jack Daniels with about that much in the bottom of it. And I just remember thinking, damn, now they're paying me to do it. I was happy to do it. Now, I didn't turn into a continuous everyday day-to-day drinker at that age, but I drank a lot. My father was a teetotaler. He didn't drink at all. But if you ever came to our house and you asked for something to drink that my father didn't have, he had it the next time you came to the house. We had a liquor closet, liquor room, that they just had cases. So I never was a big beer drinker, unless that's all you have. And then I'm a big drinker of whatever it is you have. But I would go and I'd steal, and, you know, he had, I remember it was Beefeater's gin. It was Seagram's vodka. Why he always got Bourbon Supreme, I don't know. But that was the bourbon he had. But whenever we were going out camping or something, I'd do that. And everything I learned under the influence of drink. You know, when I went into treatment, which I didn't go in because of my alcoholism. I went in because I was an attorney and I had a client that was going to get screwed the next day. And the only excuse I could think of was to go hide at a treatment center. And I figured I could probably get away with, you know, half gallon a day, you know, probably qualified. And so that's why I went to the, went into treatment. And where was I going with that? I don't know. But, all right, pregnant pause. Excuse me. Sorry about this, people on Zoom. But, oh, I know. When I went into treatment, all my friends were like, Cliff, you don't have a problem with drinking. You drink more than all of us, and you're still the designated driver. Because I was, you know, and to be honest with you, I used to joke about it, but, you know, they say that most drinkers are going to have 2.4 accidents in their life related to alcohol. I'd already had 4, so I was safer than anybody, you know. I mean, that was some of the stupid stuff I would tell myself. Whatever I did, I ended up getting away with it. I was one of these people that I wasn't one that always had to be number one, And I think I got that from elementary school. In like seventh grade, my father had always wanted me to get all A's and B's. And I always had a C on every report card for something. And I remember the first time I got all A's and B's, and I was so excited. And I went home and I was just so excited to show that report card to Dad. And he looked at it, and then he looked at the back of the report card where the teacher writes the comments. And you know what that nun had the nerve to write on that report card that had all A's and B's? She said, "This is good, but Cliff can do better." And you know, that was the only thing my father saw on that report card. I had worked so hard to do so. And so, you know, from then on, I just kind of had the attitude of, I'm just going to do what I have to do to get to the next thing I want. You know, and when I went to University of Richmond, was in a fraternity, and I mean, we looked forward to summertime being over with back then. I feel sorry for college kids nowadays. I really do. I went back for a visit one time, and they were having to decide what one night a week they were going to have a party, that they had to tell the school what one night a week they were going to have. And I mean, we protested when they said we couldn't have them 7 nights a week, that we had to have one night that we didn't have a keg or along that bottle part. And nowadays, I mean, they just can't get away with anything. But just a whole lot of, but I did what I had to do to get to the next thing. In college, I wanted to go to law school. I ended up getting accepted to a law school down in Texas. I say it was to see another part of the country or to do something. It was the only one that let me in, but one that let me in. And so funny enough, and I remember distinctly thinking, you know, it's probably good I'm going there because I don't know anybody. And you probably have to study harder in law school than what you do in college. And thank God I was wrong about that. Because I got off the plane at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and I was best friends with the biggest dealer on campus by 6 o'clock. And law school was no different than the rest. And I did. I stayed down there, and I flunked the Texas bar exam twice. You know, always knew I was coming back. But remember, there was a time that my and I do have one ex that lives in Texas that lasted about 2 months. We lived together for 2 years, and after 2 months, she went to Vegas with her boss and his wife for something really weird. I wish I'd known she was into it, but yeah, she didn't tell me about that part. And I remember my father and my brother flew down to Texas to check on me. And I ended up coming back to Virginia in 1986. And for the first time, I truly committed myself because of having flunked the Texas bar twice. I said, I am only taking the Virginia bar one time. And thankfully I did. I really dedicated myself to it and got serious about it. And I passed it the first time. But I didn't like being a lawyer. So that was kind of a conflict. But I can remember I drank. I mean, it was great being an attorney because that's what you do. That's what attorneys, you know, especially back then. I think they still do it a lot now. But especially back then, you know, you drank. You drank before court, you drank after court, you just drank. And I forget one time, my 35th birthday, I fell over the railing on the staircase, outside staircase, and landed, and I was bruised from the top of my head to the soles of my feet. And I was a court-appointed attorney the next day. in juvenile court. And that's where the attorney just shows up for the day. You may have cases, you may not have cases. And it became fairly evident after about 45 minutes, they weren't going to have any cases. So I asked Judge Cox if I could go home, that I wasn't feeling real well. And he said, yeah, I think you should. And I overheard the bailiff ask the judge, should I call the ambulance for him? And Judge Cox just said, nah, just let him go. But into my drinking, you know, I was a functioning alcoholic. Now, I really liked what I heard, and it applied at the time because I was on my second wife at the time. A functional alcoholic has a wife that makes the money, because I wasn't making any. You know, my daily routine, the last 6 months of my drinking, where my wife taught school. So I would wake up, have my first conscious thought about 5 a.m. And then I'd just have to lay there and wait for her to get ready, pretend like I was still sleeping, wait for her to get ready and leave. And as soon as the door closed, I was up and I was going and making sure her taillights left the driveway. And I was getting the bottle of vodka out of the freezer. And, you know, that those 2 hours, I describe what those 2 hours from 5 to 7, you ever watch them draw the lottery drawing where they flick that switch and all those ping pong balls get going? That's my head at that first conscious thought. And all those ping pong balls were everything I should have done yesterday, but I didn't do. Everything I did do yesterday that I shouldn't have done. Everything I've still got to do. And for me, the drinking, it didn't make them go away, but it just made me not give a shit. Made me not care about it anymore. And you know, at the end, bless you. At the end of my drinking, I woke up also during those 2 hours. I'm not going to drink today. I'm not going to drink today. This is what I've got to do to get my act together. And this is how I'm going to straighten up my life. And I knew that I could not drink. And, you know, by the time I was brushing my teeth, I changed my mind. It says in We Agnostic, the two questions, if when you really want to, you find you can't quit entirely, or if when you drink, you have no control over the amount you drank. For a long time, that didn't apply to me in my mind, because I wanted every drink I took. You know, now, half hour earlier, I swore I wasn't going to drink, but I changed my mind. And thankfully, my sponsor finally said, Cliff, did you ever not change your mind? And I was like, well, no, I never not changed my mind. He said, maybe that's the insanity of alcoholism. And you know, I'm a firm believer. I hate to hear people talk about denial. And this is just for me. I don't speak anything on anything official other than just on me, and I'm not a real good authority about me either, but I don't like denial, because in my mind, denial means I know better, but I'm going to do it anyway. And for me, that's not what my alcoholism is. When I took that next drink, I did not know better. I honestly thought, I truly believed it was going to be different. Yeah. And the whole time growing up, the God of my understanding at that time, because I had a God, I was also one, if I get to it, I'm going to mention some stuff that I might not get to. And you can ask Billy how to get in touch with me if you want to know the rest of the story. But the God of, I knew all about God. I went to Catholic grade school for first through seventh grade. back when we had the nuns and the gray habits and the hats and the, you know, big rosaries hanging off their belt and stuff. I was an altar boy. I was a lector for the last 7 years of my drinking at St. Mary's Church in Fredericksburg. And I taught seventh grade CCD class for the last 3 years of my drinking. I could tell you all about God. My problem was I didn't like him, the God of my understanding. The God of my understanding at that point was just keeping score. I like what a guy, Ray O'Keefe, says. He said he was taught that God loves good little boys and good little girls. And by the time he was 12, he no longer qualified. And that's what that's the way I felt. But I thought maybe I could earn some brownie points by doing that stuff for the church. And plus it just, you know, made me look good in the community and all that other stuff. But I didn't like him. He was mean. I really like what Dr. Paul says about when we get up to the pearly gates and St. Peter's up there and he's going to have this book and stuff. And everybody thinks he's going to ask you, you know, were you good or not? And Dr. Paul says he doesn't think he's going to ask you that. He says, because they already know that. He said, what he's going to ask you is, did you have fun? And if you say, well, no, not really. And St. Peter's going to say, well, if you didn't like it there, you won't like it here, so you can go to hell. One of the things I can tell you, I'm one of these sick people that I am so thankful that I am an alcoholic. Because, and I might not get to anything I've already talked about, but one of the things I can really relate to, and it's been a problem with me my whole life, is that I am an absolute spoiled brat. I have been. I was spoiled by my parents. As terrible of stories as I could tell you, but I, when I get honest about it and look back on it, I was just loved more than anybody should have been. And I'm a brat, and I was a brat back then. I absolutely insisted on enjoying life, and being sober sucked. So that's why I drank. You know, I had to drink. There was another saying that I like that at first I drank to feel good. It's not that I felt bad when I wasn't drinking, but I felt a little better when I was drinking. So I started drinking to feel good. Eventually, it got to the point to where I was drinking to not feel bad. Because when I wasn't drinking, I was feeling bad. And at the end of my drinking, I was drinking just to not feel. Just to try not to feel. I was one that alcohol stopped working for. Didn't matter how much I drank. I would go from being as selfish and self-conscious and self-aware and, you know, World War III going on between my ears. You know, remember the last New Year's Eve party my wife and I went to? There were four other couples, and they were getting stupid drunk. Yeah, you see, people still do that. They just get silly drunk. You know, they dance and they hoot and holler and all that. And that's what they were getting like. And I'm sitting there on the couch knowing I drank more than all of them, even before, you know, held by lunch that day. And I am just as self-conscious and, you know, beating myself up and worried about this and worried about that, that I could not drink that out of my head anymore. If I drank that out of my head, then I drank to the point of either a blackout, and thankfully I wasn't a big blackout drinker, but I drank to the point of, I used to say I'd fall asleep with a drink. No, I passed out. And thankfully I did, because it'd probably be a different story if I did. But so I knew all about that. I like the... And so the You know, we agnostic as far as getting a God of my understanding. You know, it's a totally different God today than it was back then. One of the things I remember, and I like to think some of the stuff I say is original, but I can guarantee you I am a super big, and hopefully I'll tell you about what I do today for my sobriety. I've got probably 2,000 speakers on a separate portable hard drive, and I drive a lot. And so I was telling them, I was listening to the State Line Retreat from a few years back on the ride over here. That's all I listen to, unless I have someone else in the car, and then I put the radio on. But and so I'd like to think I've got some original stuff, but I can tell you, even the stuff I thought was original, I have heard people say. And this story is one of them. I thought I was the only one that had this story, but there was another guy that said it. He said, and the story goes, when I was in like second or third grade, and it was religion class, catechism class, and the back then it was pre-Vatican II, so the Catholic Church was really radical at that point. And they said, if you're not baptized, you're going to hell. You can't go to heaven, period. And I remember having the conversation with the nun in the hallway going, but what about the little guy that's never heard about the church? That's, you know, over in Africa, down in South America, that just is loved by everybody and takes care of everybody. Anybody's never even heard of baptism or going to church or the Bible. And she looked me straight in the face and she said, nope, he can't go to heaven. And it was at that point. But what I came here with was also my entire life. There was a little part of me that just really didn't want him to be like that. And that's what I found when I found y'all. Y'all said he doesn't have to be like that. He can be the God of your understanding. You know. And I love Bill's story and the way Bill talks about it. When Abby was saying, you know, and Bill say mentions it twice in his story that he believed in the spirit of the universe. He believed there was something out there. He said, but when they spoke to me of a God personal to me, that's when my mind snapped shut. And it probably wasn't so much that I didn't want one personal to me. I just didn't want that one personal to me. And y'all told me it could be something else. Another story I heard about Bill and Abby, someone talked about, because you read it in the book, it just sounds real nonchalant. So then my friend suggested something novel. Says, why don't you come up with your own conception? And the speaker said, that's probably not how that conversation went. Said Bill was probably arguing with him about it. And finally, Abby said, Bill, pick your own damn God. And that's, I can see that. That makes a little more sense to me, because I could see that's what they'd have to do with me. But but you know, when I found the rooms, and it was kind of neat, just the God instances in my sobriety, just right from the very beginning. First time I went into treatment in 95, I went into Snowden in Fredericksburg, and my father was a doctor in Fredericksburg. And, you know, when you go into treatment, you're supposed to be able to say, nobody can come see me. And, you know, they have to get your permission to let anybody come see you. But when you're Dr. Rose in Fredericksburg, who's been there for 30 years, he walks in and they, oh, hi, Dr. Rose, sure, go right on in. He walked back to me 3 times that first day and just got right in my face and said, what the hell's your problem? Why the hell are you here? He had no understanding of it. And really, it took another 3 or 4 years before he did, and that took another doctor going into recovery before he finally kind of did it. It's another good story about him, but I'm going to try not to go to that one yet. I am very scattered brained, as you can tell. But so I transferred to another treatment center down in Newport News the next day. And I will tell you, I'm one that I loved treatment. It was safe. It was warm. The people were nice. The food was not bad. I'd still be there today if they'd have let me. And I think my higher power knew that I would. Because on the 13th day down there at the treatment center, the insurance company called him and said, he's not bad enough. You know, he's going to have to be self-pay from now on. And I thank God it was a locked place that I was in the afternoon they told me, and they said they were going to drive me home the next day because I'd have left. And I thank God for the people that I was in there with were some good people. I'm so thankful that 90% of the people that worked in that treatment center were in recovery. Yeah. I refer to every once in a while, but it's the only way I can describe it. My alcoholism is a little asshole in the back of my head. And he is still there today. And I remember going into and checking in at that second treatment center down in Newport News. And I don't know her name. I probably wouldn't recognize her, but I'd probably recognize her eyes if I look straight into her eyes. That the nurse that checked me in was the first person that I really believe could see that little asshole and told me it doesn't have to be like that. And I believed her, you know. Driving back, it was Friday the 13th that they drove me back from Newport News and coming back to Fredericksburg. And you know, I was an attorney. I had my own office and you know, doctor's son. Kind of on the ride back, things started going, you know, maybe Cliff, maybe, you know, maybe this isn't for you, you know, because I couldn't be an alcoholic. I represented alcoholics. But for me, the alcoholic was still the bum under the bridge, was still the thing. I still remember and had to apologize to this one client because he used to call and tell me, you know, I tested positive for alcohol when I went to see my probation officer. And I'd be like, you know, Bubba, how long had you had that appointment for the probation officer? Well, about 2 weeks. And you couldn't not drink. You knew about the appointment for 2 weeks and you still showed up with alcohol. Now, the whole time I'm yelling at him on the phone, I've got a big gulp glass full of vodka talking to him about his drinking, you know, just some of the ironies. But driving back, this was back when we had phone books. And back when you didn't have caller ID, y'all just don't know how lucky you've got it nowadays. You know, it was utter terror when the phone rang. And but I looked up in the phone book. I found AA in Fredericksburg, and I found out they had a speaker meeting Friday night. And it was at Trinity Church. And I went there, and I think God knew what I was thinking about. Maybe I'm making a big deal out of this. Because God had a guy in a coat and tie. He wasn't an attorney, but he was a stockbroker. And he talked about going to lunch and never making it back to his office. He talked about having a few drinks before work and never making it to the office at all. Basically, he told my story. And it was exactly what I needed to hear. And I love the way the God, you know, my God works things too. Because 5 years later, I represented that guy, and I don't want a single thing he has. But that night, he had what I wanted. And he said what I needed to hear. And that has happened so much. Shortly after, basically what happened between number one and number two, is I really love the higher power idea and stuff like that. But I love the purpose of this meeting, to keep things book and program oriented and not just keep the plug in the jug and stuff. You know, it's because I really think I got talked out of it during those first few years, and I had some success. I wasn't going to be an attorney again. And then within a year, my name was the first name on the sign that we were putting up for a new firm. I got a case that got me some notoriety. I was on Dateline NBC in 1998. Hoda Kotb came to Fredericksburg and interviewed me. I got divorced from that first wife. I waited a year, but then it was still bad after a year. So I got divorced from her, and I was dating the prettiest girl in AA. Ended up being engaged with her. I got everything I wanted. But then I got in control. And then I got to where AA was good. And I had this stuff memorized back then. I mean, I could recite how it works for you after 2 months. And it was a real shock to people when I picked up my second 24-hour chip, because I was going to meetings. I'm one that you can go to meetings and still flip up. Thankfully, I never took another drink, but I did have access to and really get into some of those outside issues that we don't talk about. And some people still say, well, then your sobriety date's still the 95 one. That just, for me, sobriety is peace of mind, is only not needing anything. And so I had found those outside issues, and I had gotten to the point to where AA was good, but it wasn't quite good enough. And I don't know about y'all, but I don't do not quite good enough very well, because I can fix it. But I can't stand it until I fix it. So I had to do these things to help me stand it until I could fix it. And then you can't fix it while you're doing those things. And you start, like I said, I am so thankful I did not crawl back into the bottom of a bottle of vodka. Yeah. I mean, another little God coincidence. I ended up representing one of our local bars, Mother's Public House. It was a college dive in Fredericksburg. And the ABC store was going to take their liquor license from them. And that was our clubhouse. That was our hangout. So I couldn't allow that. So the day of the hearing was the day of the Oklahoma City Ballman, because I remember seeing that on the TVs during lunch. And I ended up winning that case. And so I drank for free from April to September at that bar. I remember the best day of my life was walking into the bar and saying, hey, Chris, can you get me a vodka tonic? And he was the owner. And he said, Cliff, you know where it is. Make your own damn drink. I had arrived. Yeah. So those last 6 months, what I did was that little wake up 2-hour period, gonna fix my life, not gonna do it again, but then change my mind. Then I sit there with the lights out and the drapes drawn, half gallon in my lap and a little terry cloth robe, watching TV until the end of The Price is Right. I'm a Price is Right expert. And then I'd take a shower, I'd put on a coat and tie and everything, and I'd go to Mother's Public House. It didn't open until 4 o'clock, but there were like 6 of us that could go because they started cleaning up and setting up around noon or 1 o'clock. So we could go there and hang out for the afternoon, and they had a dartboard, a foosball table, a jukebox, and a TV, and a bar. What more do you want? Yeah. So it was kind of the boys' club. And I would hang out there until about 5 or 5:30. At my office, I had an answering machine. And you press two buttons and it would rewind the tape. We didn't have instant things like the cell phones do now. You had to rewind tapes and stuff like that. And I would listen to how long it took. It would beep for every second it was rewinding. And I'd do that, and I'd listen for how many beeps for how long it took to rewind. But as soon as it got ready to start playing, I'd hang up. Because I just wanted to know people were looking for me. I didn't want to know why. For some reason, I needed to know that somebody, even if they were looking for me for bad reasons. But anyway, don't know why I went down that road, God. But when I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, I fell in love. But then I got, kind of reset things. And then I broke up with the prettiest girl in AA. And I would love to have said, because that was in January of 2005. And I'd love to say that I instantly stopped all the outside issues and that it was her fault that I had to do all that stuff, but I was still doing it. Now, I did find conferences, though, in January and February, and I fell in love with conferences. And then I went to the Natural Bridge Conference, Fellowship of the Spirit, and a guy, Tom I, and I think most of y'all have heard of him, was speaking. And Tom had 46 years of sobriety at the time. And he was on fire. You could just tell he loved getting up in the morning. He loved AA. He loved his life. And it was an incredible story that his life was. And talked with him some outside of the meetings and stuff. And he was just the friend. He talked to anybody about anything, as long as it included sobriety and a higher power. And he was the one that convinced me that it wasn't that AA is not good enough. It said, Cliff, you ain't doing AA. You're going to meetings. You're not drinking, but you're not doing AA. You don't have that God personal to you. And it was from that point on that I actually tried doing the stuff that this book says to do. Not just tell you to pause when agitated or doubtful, but me actually pause when agitated or doubtful. One of my favorite parts in the book is where it talks about the fear and the line that it says, we ask God to remove our fear and direct our attention. I always thought it was to direct my attention to what you need me to do. But that's not what that line says. It says, remove my fear and direct my attention to what you would have me be. And I am a firm believer that my higher power would have me be still, shut up, and stay out of his way. Probably 80% of the time. Now, I'm only good at doing it about 5% of the time. But when I do, remarkable things happen. It wasn't until I was willing to actually do it that my God was able to show me what he could do. It goes along with that thing about giving God your problem and, waiting a week and going back and taking it back and saying, God, you didn't fix anything. He says, well, you never let go of it. It wasn't until I was willing to actually pause when agitated or doubtful, not talk about it later and say, yeah, I should have done that, but actually doing it, that's when my God was able to show me what he could do. I used to really hope that he was there. And hope that he was what y'all were telling me I could think I wanted for my God. But now I can tell you after these 16 years, I know he's there. And I loved riding over here and listening to the speakers and stuff. And it just, and the sky and the, you know, had some clouds. And then there was this hole that just had this bright beams of light shining down. You know, I want to say they were shining over here because that's where I was going. Nah, probably not quite. But when I started doing that, you know, I ended up, I finally closed my law practice just because I hated practicing law. You know, I love running my mouth, which attorneys get to do a lot, but I didn't like the rest of it. And you know, this is just a whole bunch of coincidences, but they're really kind of cool the way they fit together. So I ended up applying for a job as a magistrate. Now, I say I've never been homeless, but I had moved back in with my mother. And someone said, you know, Cliff, unless you're living in your house, you're homeless. If you're living in someone else's. And I will tell you, I finally, at 48, I got fed up with my mother and I moved out for the last time. I told her I wasn't going to take it. But I was living with her. I didn't have much expenses. Masters don't make a whole lot of money. And so it was going to be an okay thing for me to do. And they were still went through some changes and stuff in 2008, 2010. So it was going to be okay. And so I applied for the job in Fredericksburg, didn't get hired by the chief over there. So I applied over in Charlottesville that included Culpeper and everything. And I did get hired over there. Well, as it turns out, the people that got hired over there got to go through training before the people that got hired in Fredericksburg. And it was while I was in that training that the chief position over in Fredericksburg opened up. And so I knew all the judges. I knew all the clerks. I'd been a criminal defense attorney for 23 years. And so I applied for it. And because I'd already met all the people through going to the certification school, I was more than just a name on the application. I became the magistrate in February and I was chief in July. And it was a good thing because between February and July, I found out I was going to be a daddy for the first time. I have an 11-year-old at home. Yeah. And, you know, while the me, you know, while the salary for a magistrate was going to be enough just for Cliff to make it by on, it wasn't going to be enough for Cliff and my family. And so, you know, I could have, when the chief over in Fredericksburg didn't hire me, I could have said, screw the whole magistrate system. I'm not going to do that. But I didn't. I went ahead and I was willing to make the drive and do what it had to do. And so, you know, and I got hired. And apparently the chief that hired me over in Charlottesville was only a chief for about 6 months because she got fired. And technically in Richmond, her name is the name whose the chief whose name shall not be uttered. They don't even want to hear her name in Richmond. I love the lady because she hired me. And if she hadn't done it, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing. You know? I mean, coincidence? I don't know. You know, my life today is, you know, I mean, for one, I've got an 11-year-old. He was born on 10-10-10. So he just had his 11th birthday week ago today, actually. And, you know, I was 52 years old when he was born. I thought I was going to be Uncle Cliff for the rest of my life. And I was happy with that. I have 9 nieces and nephews. I have a great niece and a great nephew older than my son. You know, my brother's daughter had 2 kids before I had my first one. But you know, and it's just so neat. I've got to be honest with you, though. The very first thought, I'm 52 years old, and you're telling me I'm going to be a dad for the first time, and I'm working at a real low-paying job. It was not up there on the yay scale, you know. But it quickly changed. Right now, I would not trade it for the world. Absolute joy. Despite the fact that he broke his foot 2 weeks ago and we had surgery on it. So now he's going around on crutches the whole time and I get to play servant. But, you know, I get to play servant. I get to be there for him. You know, he's 11 and he still calls me dada. Everything dada. Hey, dada. Yeah. And you know, I get to be a brat today. You know, I started this off by telling y'all I drink because I'm a brat. And now I do this because I'm a brat. I know this one's red, but it's that little red one that is the 164 pages. I get this because I get these by the case and I give them away. And they are, I feel guilty for not supporting GSO and getting their material, but, you know, it's almost less than half the price. And I give away a lot of these things. So I believe in quantity. So, and you know, I get to be a brat today. It's really kind of funny. My job, I'm chief magistrate of the largest district in the state. Getting real close. When I first got that job, about 4 months into it, I had my first hip replaced. And I was back at work in 2 weeks. They went through a new process for doing it. And I was a brand new chief and I was afraid, you know, they're going to replace me if I don't, you know. So I pushed and I was back in 2 weeks. And 4 years later, I had the other hip replaced. And, you know, I took all 6 weeks of that sick leave because I know they couldn't give my job away. I had no idea what I was getting into. You know, I manage 25 magistrates today. You know, and I told them I didn't manage myself well for 50 years. And now you got me in charge. And I don't say any of this because it's me, all right? And, you know, I sometimes I feel guilty and I don't want to say it, but it's not because it sounds like I'm bragging, but it's not me bragging. This is what God has done in my life. And this is what God continues to do on a daily basis if I ask him, you know. I love, and it's the only part that I'll actually read, page 100. And I'm sure some of y'all, I'm guessing, probably already know the paragraph. But where it says, both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. If you persist, remarkable things will happen. When we look back, we realize that the things which came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. Follow the dictates of a higher power, and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances. You know, now that better than anything I could have planned, that pisses me off for two reasons. Because one, it implies that I have a plan. And number two means it ain't going according to my plan. But, you know, when I do this, I will tell you one of the biggest ways my God works on me is he works on me with distractions. I have to be willing to be distracted. I'm working on something hard and that's a big problem at work and I'm, you know, schedules is mad time of the month. But I'm working on that and I'm figuring and I'm getting it. And the next thing I know, Glenn calls on my phone. And it's like, well, I'll call him. You know, I used to say, I'll call him back. I'm doing something more important. You know, today, that phone call was God's answer to my prayer for help. That's God saying, Cliff, you go take care of another one of my kids. And when you come back, this will make more sense. And it does. You know, the thing is, you know, so, and, you know, Dr. Paul says, you know, there's a hard, and Chuck C. said there's a hard way and there's an easy way. And if it's hard, then it's probably not the right way. Yeah, I'm a believer in that. Yeah. And I like what Chuck C. said when people told him, Chuck, you can't live that way. It just, life doesn't go like that. He says, well, I've been doing it for 19 years, so I'm going to keep doing it. And you can do whatever you think you want to do. That's what I do. I feel like I've got gutter guards. You know, when you used to go to the bowling alley and they had those inflatable things where the kids can't bowl a gutter ball. You know, nowadays, they only go up when the kid is bowling. I don't like that. It goes back down when I bowl. But you know, that's what I feel like I get to do with this program and with the God of my understanding. When things start getting a little rough, that's God telling me, Cliff, you probably shouldn't be doing this. You know, it's not to say I don't do things that are hard. Hell, everybody in the management system thinks I've got the hardest job in the system. I think it's the easiest one. Yeah. And I do it. I practice these principles in all my affairs. Pause when agitated or doubtful. Humbly remind myself many times each day I'm no longer running the show. That's not just something I did for the first year. That's something I have to do now with 16 years later. And you know why I have to do it even more so now? Because I think I should be running the show many times each day. You know, I love this book. I love this program. And I love you guys. I hope some of that made some sense.
My partner's Matt.
Oh, man.